a song, place of our birth. We all are witness to the
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy. This week we'll be doing a two-part show called Traveler's Insights. In the first half of the hour, we'll interview Chico and Chris Nelson about her recent travels in Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, Alberta, Montana, and Idaho with her husband, Michael Pike. They traveled in the Veggie Voyager, a diesel RV that Michael has converted to run on vegetable oil. Chris will talk with us about her observations on what's happening to the natural world as a result of the consumption of natural resources.
And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll swap microphones, and Chris will interview us about our recent trip to India, some of our observations about environmental conditions in northern India, and whether efforts there to balance population needs with consumption and waste are accomplishing their aims.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by Grid Alternatives, a nonprofit organization bringing the benefits of renewable technology to low-income communities in the North State and beyond. Grid Alternatives leads teams of job trainees community volunteers, and corporate sponsors to install solar power for cost-burdened homeowners across the state. Call the North Valley Regional Office to learn how to get involved at 530-217-6115. Ecotopia is also made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by Aqua Alliance hosting a unique two-day conference to provide historical, scientific, legal, political, and visionary information regarding California's water. This conference will be held at the Sierra Nevada Big Room on November 29th and 30th. For more information, visit aquaalliance.net. Let me spell that, AQUALLIANCE, aquaalliance.net, or call 595-9420.
And we want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, or programmers. Tonight, our topic is Traveler's Insights, and in the studio with us is Chris Nelson. She's a longtime KZFR programmer. She's also a retired public health, semi-retired, public health nurse, women's health care nurse practitioner. She's a local activist in the areas of peace, justice, and the environment.
In 2007 and 2008, Chris and her husband, Michael Pike, also a retired RN in emergency room care, spent 10 months traveling around the U.S. and parts of Canada on waste cooking oil from restaurants. Chris authored the book, The Veggie Voyagers, an Eco-Friendly Low-Budget Loop of North America's Wild Places, powered by used cooking oil. And she also has a blog, www.veggievoyagersblogspot.com.
This summer, from July to November, Chris and Michael did another low-budget loop of North America's wild places. They looped up through Oregon and Washington into B.C., western Alberta, back down through Montana, Idaho, and Oregon. They're still running on veggie oil, and they focused their trip on wild areas, noting concerns about the extractive industries that are exploiting the earth and risking the future of the web of life. Welcome, Chris Nelson.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Perhaps if you could first just give us an outline of the trip. We've done the geography, but tell us why you went and where you went.
Well, we went because we could, and, you know, running on waste oil really helps save money. We're both retired, and we're not wealthy people, but this idea was already planted in our heads from 5 years ago, and we knew we could, you know, we could do this trip. So the only thing we really knew, or I really knew I wanted to go to, was a place called Kitimat in British Columbia. And because I'd heard of the Northern Gateway pipeline that was supposed to bring the tar sands oil from Alberta and pipeline it all the way to Kitimat, and then it was supposed to be loaded on tankers at the terminal end of Douglas Channel, which is a very long channel, and then out through the inside passage and to China, basically, into the Asian Rim countries. And so I had read in my Sierra Club magazine from May and June about, called the article is the lead article, The Monster in the Mist, and it talks about the Great Bear Rainforest, and I learned about Komodo bears, which are white bears that you only find on the in this area, of about the nursery grounds of the humpback whales, and about the great risk of tanker disaster like we saw with the Exxon Valdez. And it just like fired my heart to want to go up there and just see for myself what it was like. So we took a ferry from Vancouver Island that goes from Port Hardy, the northern end, up to Prince Rupert. And so we were able to, we can't afford to, you know, rent a boat and do all these things that these people on the Sierra Club could do. But we were able to see, you know, where it would exit, get an idea of the channel, and form our own ideas about how foolish it is to run it was the same thing, these really long tankers having to make these turns. It's so foolhardy, and it's pristine along there. I mean, a lot of this area hasn't been logged, and there's, you know, fisheries that are very vibrant and healthy, and it's a beautiful trip on the Inside Passage. So anyway, that was the first thing that I wanted to do. And then from there, we just created the trip. So we landed in Prince Rupert, and we made our way along. And as we went, we just kept seeing, roads that were closed that you couldn't go into, and learning more about what was happening with mining claims and different things as we went. And then, so I'll let you ask me, but like, say, we got to an area called Dees Lake, and we found out about, we saw, you know, we were seeing grizzly bears and all kinds of animals. I mean, there's, it's incredibly beautiful. And you get to a point where you don't even, I love the Canadian radio broadcasts. You get to a point where you're not even getting that, where there's, you know, there isn't any telephone poles, there aren't any little cottages. It's just miles and miles and miles of natural environment. So
how far north are we at this point?
When you get up north of Mesiaden Junction, we had gone over to a place called Stewart and Hyder, which the reason those two are attractive to us is because they're back-to-back towns, one's in Alaska and one's in Canada. And we thought, oh, it would be so neat, because there's a huge glacier there. And, of course, it's melting rather badly. And there's a couple of glaciers, the Bear Glacier and the Salmon Glacier. And so we just wanted to see that. But there's also a place in Hyder where you can observe animals, where they come because of the salmon runs. I mean, the rivers are just full of salmon. I mean, just, you know, just how it used to be, I think, here. And so all the animals come for the feed. And so we got to see grizzlies and brown bears and wolves, you know, feeding in the river. And it was, you know, it was a really precious experience. And
at what distance were you at this point? Are the animals spooked by humans, or
not really?
They've
created a walkway, a railed with railings, and tourists can go up there and just look down on the animals. And the animals, they ask you not to use flashes. Other than that, they're pretty well habituated to humans being at that distance from them. So it's, you know, it's kind of like in Glacier, where you see a lot of animals, and they're used to humans, and they know you're not going to kill them. Whereas in other areas, they see you and they just, shoom, they're gone. I mean, right. You see the back end of wolves and the back end of grizzlies, you know, all the time, but you don't see them just hanging out.
Were you able to learn how the melting of the glaciers is affecting the habitat there and the creatures that live there?
I think that
what the impact of this is.
Well, the whole climate change issue is that the rivers in British Columbia are just full to overflowing. They're just, you know, there's gray, and they're, you know, they have a lot of turbidity from the glacier melt, and what's happening is it warms. There's more rain at lower elevation, less snow at higher,
right.
And so it's the tree line is moving up, but it hasn't really affected there's so much disease in the trees now with the pine bark beetle.
Oh, right.
There's so many fires, you know. We came on fires, you know, everywhere we went. Montana being the worst, but Idaho was totally destroyed. I mean, I'm seeing it all as one big. I mean, when you talk about Cascadia, you're talking about Oregon, Washington, British Columbia. It's all of a piece. But, you know, this just the clear cutting that you see everywhere is horrendous. And so all of that is affecting climate change up there and this melting of the glaciers. And in places that still have pretty good glacier sizes, you know, the Athabasca and some of these other glaciers are still relatively large, you know, there's still some time left. But when you go, like, into Montana and you see the glaciers that remain there, that are, there's only a few of them, they're very small. And, you know, pretty soon there isn't going to be any water. There's not going to be surface water because there will be no glaciers. And so it'd be, they'll be more seasonal. And I don't really know how the environment's going to stand it. And already in Alberta, so Alberta's on the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains. And their situation is a lot like how it is along the front line of our Rockies. You know, we had that huge wildfire in the Denver area, north of Denver, last summer, and they have no water, you know, even to fight their fires. And it's the same sort of thing. Alberta has four rivers, and those rivers have been dammed, but they have no wild and scenic rivers in Alberta. But
really?
There isn't enough water for everything.
Wow.
And now they want to do this hydraulic fracturing, which they're also doing in British Columbia, up around Fort Nelson. And that's it's really, really, you know, it takes huge amounts of water.
Right. And then pollutes the water.
Terribly pollutes the water. In British Columbia, I noticed when I went in and looked at about fracking, one of our big issues in the United States is to try and find out what's in this fracking fluid.
Right.
And so we've been mostly unsuccessful in getting them to give us that trade information. But in British Columbia, they do have a law that they have to reveal what's in the fracking fluids.
Okay.
And they are, you know, they are at least, you know, they have some things, but the problem is it's just, there's so much of it. I just wanted to, Steve, you had asked me about Site C.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, just to tell a little story about this area, called Hudson's Hope. And there's this, you come into this valley and it's just lush, and people have been farming there since the 1800s. And the First Nations people have always used that area as a corridor. There's many, many species of, you know, of wildlife and animals. And it's got wetlands, it's got everything. It's just this beautiful valley. And they already have like this just huge lake called Williston Lake. They flooded this enormous amount of acreage. And they want to flood this valley. It will affect three different river systems, the main one being the Peace River, and this Peace River Valley, and it's called Site C. And the people and the environmentalists from British Columbia have been fighting it for years now, but it's going to happen. It'll destroy many, many Native American sacred sites and burial sites. It'll destroy the only good farming land that's north of, in the north part of the country, and drive people from their homes, and it's just terrible.
What's the purpose of this? Is this for power?
Well, here's the thing. They have a glut of hydro. They're number one in production of hydroelectricity in the world, Canada is.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to use that for fracking. The energy used is for fracking.
Oh, dear.
And it's like, okay, this is not okay, you know? And everyone in Canada, I think, has, you know, it's the same thing. And we can't seem to get a handle on our governments. We can't seem to get a handle on these corporations. They don't pay their fair share of taxes up there. The British Columbia, their healthcare system is failing. Their care for the people is failing. I mean, they act like, you know, like things are not going well in British Columbia. They're all taxed, but the corporations are not paying their fair shares. They're not, you know, doing what they should be doing, and they're making money hand over fist. I mean, the minerals coming out of Canada, like I said, every road is closed, and it's because if you're going up north toward the Yukon, on the area that I was talking about from Hyder and Stewart, on Highway 37, it's mining. So it might be jade, it might be copper, it might be silver. It's different. It's the mining. And then, of course, you've got all the pollution caused by that into the water. We went up this abandoned area. It's called Cassiar Highway. And we saw this huge mountain, and it was all asbestos tailings.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So because we'd blown a radiator hose, so we went up to where these kind of backwoods people had lots of broken down trucks and things like that. So anyway, it's and then if you go once you get like we just made a loop. So the furthest north we got was Watson Lake, which is in the Yukon, and then we came back down the Alcan Highway, which the U.S. built this highway in order to protect Alaska, the Aleutians, from the Japanese during World War II, and then they handed it over to Canada, and Canada has maintained it. But it's a source of pride, this highway, and there's where most of the tourism, you know, people, if they're on their way to Alaska, they go up the Alcan. But that's how we kind of got ourselves into the boreal forests and found out about all the fracking in that corner. The northeast corner of British Columbia.
And where is the fracked gas going at this point? What's its route out of that area, and who's getting it?
Well, at this point, I don't know what they're doing with it all. They're banking on Keystone XL, mm-hmm. which is most of your listeners, I hope, know what that is. They want to. That's the bitumen that they're going to send down in the Keystone XL, but the fracked natural gas they've been using domestically, and they're also that's all going to China also, and so everything, China is taking over a lot of the companies. While we were there, they took over one named Nexan, and everybody was afraid that they were going to take over one called Encana, and Encana let it go because they couldn't figure out how they were going to co-manage it. The money wasn't a problem. They were ready to sell, but they couldn't. The Chinese have, you know, different ideas about, like, who is going to be management and how is it going to be run, and I mean, it's a totally different culture. And so when you allow your country to be bought up by foreign interests, you know, how are you going to manage that? But there's Malaysian, there's Japanese. We were riding our bikes in the middle of nowhere on an old roadbed that was abandoned, and we ran into people who didn't speak any English, who were from Korea, and they were mining for something. I mean, I think there's people that are just like fly-by-night miners. Somebody, when we told the jade miners up the road about it, they said, oh yeah, they're probably looking for jade. So it's people.
So some people are doing this without permits or without authorization?
Hard
or
to say. They didn't speak any English.
But the rest of them are large corporations that are doing the mining?
We're talking about multi-billion dollars. And the thing about most of the oil and gas industry, it is a lot of them are located in Alberta, Calgary, Alberta. Most of them are there. And except for Petro-Canada, now that one is a crown. They still control 19% of Petro-Canada, and that's born and bred. But a lot of them are multinationals. Like, mining is that way, too. Like, they're mining all over the world. You know, they're in Guatemala, they're in Indonesia, they're in Australia, they're, you know, all over the place. And it's become so that it's really hard to hold them accountable because they don't really exist here. Like in Kitimat, which is the town I started talking about in the mm-hmm. beginning, it was so distressing to go there because the area is so polluted by, they do aluminum smelting, and Alcan, which is the company that started the smelter there, has been taken over by Rio Tinto. And Rio Tinto is an international a company that's well known for its poor treatment of people, of labor, as well as the environment everywhere it goes. And there was a Methanex plant there, and they're the ones who give us the fine MTBE spills that we have at all our gas stations, which is an additive which we have been having a lot of trouble getting out of our gasoline because NAFTA agreements between Canada and the United States. They have sued us about that. So, I mean, going there, it was just kind of heartbreaking because
really?
I could see I would kind of ask people, what do you think about, you know, this pipeline that they want? And they go, well, it's jobs, you know, it's all about jobs. And it's just
so there
a
isn't
shame.
Much resistance and what resistance there is easy to ignore because it's such a large area. And
where the resistance is along the coastline. The people, yeah. Well, first of all, First Nations people.
Yeah.
They are the backbone of resistance. We were headed toward a gathering that they basically are willing to put down their lives on this. They are not going to let that pipeline cross their lands. They are just like, no.
Right.
So they are very firm about that. But lined up behind them are all the environmentalists, but
sure.
also everybody who lives along the biggest part of the population in British Columbia lives along the coastline. You know, they're down by Vancouver, and that whole area is pretty heavily populated. And they're really worried about not only the Northern Gateway, but also our own Kinder Morgan. Here in Chico, we have a Kinder Morgan tank farm on the Midway in Hagen, and it's where oil is stored from, I think, all over the western United States. It ends up there, so it's a main terminal. It's very dangerous for us having it there because of the high risk that we face. And they've had spills before, too. But Kinder Morgan wants to do another pipeline also. So the more of these tankers, the more of these pipelines. So in British Columbia, I would say that people are, except if you were in Kitimat and directly affected by the possibility of getting a job, British Columbians are lining up against these pipelines. But in Alberta, I think they have a totally different mindset. I think that they have a different history, and they're gung-ho, and I haven't had a chance, and I know I'm about out of time, but we also came down the whole eastern side of the Rockies, and we went from the coal patch, which is miles and miles of open pit coal mining, which is terrible and the worst in terms of carbon. The air is filthy there, and then all along it's Husky, it's Petro-Canada, it's Tech, it's Canfor, which is the gazillions of board feet of timber and the clear cuts. It's just terrible, because there you really, really see it, because the trees are gone.
Yeah, right. I know that you fell in love with the beauty of the place, and I know that you found some really discouraging things, but if maybe you could just end with the description of the region that's being developed with greater parks and greater protection of the area.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
I really like that good news, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've been fantasizing a lot about how it could all work, and there's this area called the Robson Valley, and Michael and I went, they have a little tiny booklet that we found in Prince George, and we went on many of the trails and Forest Service roads that they recommended, and to see these ancient cedars and hemlocks that are thousands of years old. And this is the most intact area that remains outside of parks, and they want to create a network of expanded protected areas that safeguard the sustainability of the rainforest and all its unique features. And they've been able to do this, interconnecting Rainforest Corridor, Walker Wilderness, Old Growth Management areas, and caribou habitat for this very large protected area network. And they have worked hard, and they've worked it over many, many years. And if all of us everywhere that we are could protect our areas, then that would be a solution to a lot of our problems. And I just love these people and what they're able to do. I really know I'm out of time, but I also urge people to just don't forget about our neighbors to the north. They're extremely important to us, and what happens to their governments, their political system, and we should be watching what the Harper government is doing like hawks. We should be watching what's going on with the elections in British Columbia, and we don't pay any attention to our neighbors, and I think that they deserve and need our full participation, because this is our planet, and it's the birthright of all humans. So borders don't really matter when you look at something like as grand as Cascadia. Yeah. So thank you.
We want to thank you for being here, Chris. Want to let listeners know by way of visual radio that Chris is not only intelligent and articulate. She has acres of notes spread out in front of her and doesn't refer to them at all. This is all coming from her head with only occasional. So she really, I'm just dazzled by the amount of knowledge you have on this topic. And listeners, you can read more, www.veggievoyagers.blogspot.com. And you can also look for Chris's book, The Veggie Voyagers, an eco-friendly, low-budget loop of North America's wild places powered by used cooking oil. Where is the book available, please?
Lyons Books, and also at the University Bookstore. And it might have sold better if it was called The Veggie Voyagers. I like that. Yeah, I think you started you almost said that. But anyway, if you just Google Veggie Voyagers, you'll find us.
Great.
With an S.
Thank you.
We'll take a short break now, and then Chris will ask us questions about our recent trip to India.
We're back, and now I get to interview the Chudis, and these two fine people have just given so much to our community since they've lived here, and I know you, the listeners, may not know much about them, but they want to just steer clear about talking about themselves and go right into their topic, and that is, why in the world did you go to India when you knew ahead of time a little bit about India, its overpopulation, and its environmental issues? What made you want to go anyway?
I think that was part of the attraction. Actually, we kind of stumbled into it. India has been on our bucket list for a long time. Last January, we heard from Gail Kimball, local writer for the Lotus Guide, does balancing workshops, does a lot of things around town.
Right.
Gail had worked out an arrangement with a private guide named Dalbir Singh from the Punjab, and was kind of looking for people to go along on a small private tour. So we discussed it for not very long and decided this was just a great way to get to see India. We don't like big organized tours. We're done with the tour bus thing. So it turned out we had Dalbir as our guide. His friend Ajit, who is a Canadian Sikh from the Okanagan Valley, a recent convert to Sikhism, but very knowledgeable about the country. A driver. We were in a small minivan, spent a lot of time on pretty low-end back roads and terrifically overcrowded main roads. But we were able, through Gail, to pretty much tailor this so that we were in the Punjab for the most part, Himachal Pradesh, which is up in the Himalayas. We started out in Delhi and just had a absolutely fabulous 3 weeks where we got to see pretty much what we wanted to see in India.
It must have been kind of a shock to come into Delhi and see the evidence of overpopulation since it's such a huge city. And you also might have experienced some brownouts while you were in the city. I mean, what were your first takes on Delhi?
It's interesting to me that it didn't feel as remote or exotic as I expected it to feel. And I became acclimated to even cars that looked like they were going to crash head-on into our car because there are no traffic cops and nobody obeys any traffic. People do ride, stay basically on their... No, that's not true. They don't stay basically on their right side of the street. So that, it took me a little while to get used to that. I didn't see more poverty than I see in U.S. cities. Mm-hmm. On a daily basis. Occasionally, we would go by an area that was, cardboard and tin. But that was very rare. We saw many, many people on the streets who were shopping and who seemed prosperous. There was so much stuff. Steve is frowning. It didn't feel as oppressively poor as I expected it to feel.
Did you have a different experience?
I would agree with that, though. We didn't see the giant areas of poverty. For example, around Mumbai, where we have miles and miles of the tin roof shacks, we saw acres, but not miles. I was surprised, but what I'll call a poverty marginal middle class. A lot of people who had a little bit of expendable income, but also people working really hard to make a buck. I was looking at a number of the sidewalk stalls, which were everywhere, not only in Delhi, but out in the country. The tea wallahs, selling a cup of tea for the equivalent of 20 U.S. cents, and out there from 6 in the morning till 10 or 11 at night, running by Coleman gas lanterns after hours. And that impressed me, that there are a huge number of people like that who are perhaps not in the absolute abject poverty, but are really close to the line.
And, of course, the standards in India for living conditions are much lower. We visited several houses. We visited the house of a city council member. It was the father-in-law of Dalbir, and they had a very fancy big house. But Dalbir and his wife live in a three-room house and with a tiny kitchen and outdoor bathroom facilities. I mean, flush toilet, but shower sort of by hand outside. So the standard is really different. But to me, it was a not unreasonable standard. I mean, Americans should be living more like that, instead.
A simpler lifestyle.
Much simpler. Yeah.
So do they have, this is a dumb question, but I was just thinking about flush toilets and about how much water is wasted in flush toilets. Do they have those?
It's a huge, Steve is going to talk a little bit about the toilet museum, which was one of his favorites.
Yeah.
But they have a huge problem with sanitation. Mm. Most, many, 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 many people just squat wherever they are. Or you see men regularly urinating in bushes and, on buildings. And so the sanitation is a huge problem. And getting enough flush toilets, hardly any public flush toilets. And the ones that were there were for men. Very, very, very hard to find, though. Not typical. But we did go to, and Steve can talk a little bit about Gandhi and his standard of living for?
Well, Gandhi was deeply concerned about sanitation. At one point said sanitation is more important than independence. So on our first day in Delhi, our host said, you have to see the toilet museum, small museum in Delhi, about the size of the KZFR studios on the inside, maybe 50 feet by 50 feet, a history of toilets for the last 2,500 years, but giving Gandhi credit for being concerned about village sanitation. And this outfit is building model toilets outside the museum. There are a number of examples in the ground of brick, ceramic, small outhouse-type places, composting toilets. They had some electric-powered composting toilets on the inside, others that run totally by natural means. And their whole campaign is to educate Indians about sanitation possibilities that don't use huge quantities of water and keep disease down, keep disease out of the rivers and the waters.
Oh, yeah, I just imagine what it must be like. You also said it was a huge problem with trash, so there's, besides not minding that.
Yeah, there's no, there are some dumpsters from time to time on the road, but there are no trash bins, and people just typically just throw everything down where they are. So, they seem to be accumulated in certain places, you know, so there'll be trash places on the sidewalk or at the side of the road, and the cows and the dogs come and take stuff out of it, and pickers come and take stuff out of it. So anything that's valuable can be gotten out of it, and then the animals eat out of it, and then a lot of it is burned. And so a lot of plastic is burned.
Airborne.
Right.
Airborne.
Mm-hmm.
Delhi has established two trash to power plants, and even these were protested by some of the trash pickers, mm-hmm. because they're saying pickings are getting slimmer and slimmer as the trash is hauled off to incinerators. We did see people picking it up. There are folks employed to come around to just shovel up the trash mm-hmm. pile. So instead of the dumpsters, it just piles up in the streets.
Well, we did. Our host in Delhi was starting a composting program for all of the flowers that come to the temples. So there are flowers that are just dumped out, and he found a piece of land, talked a city councilman into letting him use that piece of land. The guy didn't get the idea of composting vegetation at all, and so our host had to do some kind of talking and convincing and educating. But now he's created this place, and he's trying to communicate the word to other temple people to collect your flowers and compost them. So, you know, one little corner where there's
small
some compost.
Steps.
Yes.
But it's a very pretty compost pile.
It's beautiful.
Mostly marigolds.
Yeah, orange.
At that time of year.
Yeah, that's neat. But I just wanted to ask you, and just stick in a question about corruption, because this reminds me a lot of Guatemala. In terms of the people, there's no taxation or no infrastructure for some of these things that we've discussed about the sanitation and the trash and any of that.
You know,
the structure of the country.
I don't know much about the structure of taxation to take care of public works. But most Indians, when you talk about change, are just accustomed to corruption. And so they know that if money is set aside for certain kinds of things, it's going to go in various pockets. And we saw a policeman bribe one of our taxi drivers.
That was the story.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were just coming back, and he stopped him to check all of his papers. Everything was in order. He looked at his first aid kit. He didn't have something in his first aid kit that he was supposed to have. And he said, if you give me, I don't know, like 100.
It was a couple hundred rupees.
Yeah, a couple hundred rupees. I'll let you go. And that, people just expect that.
Wow. So the most important thing for life is water, you know, in terms of, and you've already talked about some of the ways that the water might be contaminated, you know, by feces and things like that. But how are people getting water, you know, in the cities and in the rural areas? Mm-hmm. And what is the quality of the water?
A lot of people have to carry water a long way to get it to their houses. I mean, in Delhi, people have water coming through their taps, but we couldn't drink it. They did. Mm-hmm. But a lot of rural people walk long distances to carry water back to use it. And for me, that was more shocking than
From a well.
We did see civic pumps in Rawalsur, for example. Mm-hmm. The pumps were all identical, scattered around mm-hmm. the village, and clearly some kind of authority had put them in place. And I think there's a strong movement toward that in India. There are water wars that reminded me of the state of affairs in California, and particularly the proposed peripheral tunnels, Hetch Hetchy, the draining of Owens Valley. The Punjab, where we spent most of our time, is Sikh territory, and there's great animosity still to the fact that waters flowing through Punjab are sent elsewhere, some to Pakistan, a result of partition, a lot going down to Delhi and to southern provinces. So this has been under debate now for about 30 years. They have never exactly settled the agreement, the guarantee the Punjab its present supply. But it's clear that, like Southern California, India south of the Punjab would love to get its hands on all that fresh water flowing out of the Himalayas.
And did they have any irrigation in places that you went to, or do they depend on just the rainfall?
There's a lot of irrigation in the flatlands. Mm-hmm. As you know, factory agriculture came to India in the 60s and 70s in the so-called Green Revolution. And so in the flatlands that we saw, we didn't see the big factory ag territories, but we did see huge irrigation canals, larger than anything I've seen in California, mm-hmm. with thousands of cubic feet per second flowing elsewhere. We didn't see big irrigation installations, mechanical. I think a lot of it is flood irrigation, just mm-hmm. cork it up, use your water, put it on the land, mm-hmm. And either return it to the source streams or let it go into the ground.
And that brings up the question, of course, about the Green Revolution, the use of pesticides, GMOs, and, you know, what has been the effect on the land and the people of years of that?
We spent some time on an organic farm with a Frenchman who immigrated to England because when he converted to Sikhism, they wouldn't let him take his religious name, so he went to England and then went to Punjab to farm, which he'd always wanted to do. And he said that it took him a long time to find land that had not been poisoned by herbicides, fertilizers, pesticides, the chemical results of the large farm ag companies. And he said, don't, if you don't want to know what's in your food, don't ask, because apparently it's virtually impossible to get organic food in the Punjab area and other places of northern India. He primarily farms the food that they eat. He's vegetarian, so they have cows for milk and cheese, but then he farms a lot of sugar cane, and a lot of people come to him for sugar cane. He doesn't have to market his sugar cane at all, because there are people who are looking for organic
sugar.
Organic sugar, but it's very hard to find. And, you know, we didn't have direct contact or even 6 degrees of separation, I don't think, from anybody who committed suicide. But a lot of farmers got in over their heads in India, couldn't afford to continue using all of the things from the big ag companies, and got themselves into debt and ruined their land and committed suicide or ended up bankrupt and left farming.
Yeah, that's a terrible progression. Did you want to say something about that?
I was going
to.
We did talk briefly with a former Secretary of Agriculture in the Punjab, and he was pretty optimistic about the buy local, organic, no pesticides movement. But it's fraught with problems. One of the problems with factory ag is that on scale it works. Factory ag made India a self-sufficient, not sustainable, but they went from a food importing to a food exporting country in about 20 years.
Oh.
Wrecked the soil, caused the suicides, but it does work if you want to produce lots of stuff. Mm-hmm. There's reason to go chemical. But he was very optimistic. He said, we've learned the lesson and are gradually making the transition back, and was very proud to talk about good local small-scale farms in the area.
And is organic farming, do the farmers themselves, are they able to get money back from farming organically for the extra labor that's involved in getting healthy soils?
We only met this one person, and he was doing very well farming organically.
Yeah.
He built a really nice house. He employed several people. He was able to be prosperous.
But a lot of it's happening, I think, only at the village level. We did visit a carnation farm, people growing carnations under greenhouses. And they were saying, we can't get a fair price if we ship large quantities to Delhi. We're robbed. We don't even know what we'll get. They just tell us what we'll receive. They do a little bit of local. They'll drive to Delhi with bunches of flowers and sell them on the street.
Right.
But very difficult there for the local farmer. This was not an organic farm, but tough, really tough for the small farmer to make a go of it beyond the village.
You know, in my mind, I can't really think about how they must transport, how the whole system must work. I've heard stories about trains and long, this is in a place that's extremely hot, right?
Zillions mm-hmm. and zillions and zillions of trucks.
Okay. And refrigeration not? I mean,
I didn't see any refrigerated trucks, mm-hmm. but, you know, I didn't see all the trucks.
Mm-hmm.
But we saw a lot of fresh vegetables and fruits and products. There's a lot of stuff in India, just a lot
moving
of stuff.
Around. Well, it would have to be for that many people. You'd mm-hmm. have to have very, right. very active. Mm-hmm. So what was the strangest sight you saw?
Okay, I get to tell this story. the strangest sight we saw, motor scooters, bicycles, ox carts, horses on the streets, pulling carts, cows, of course, everywhere, in and out of the traffic. But the strangest sight I saw was two guys on a motor scooter, one driving and the one sitting behind him, and stuffed between them, there were four sheep. And they
You're
weren't baby
about live
sheep.
Sheep, are
yeah,
you not?
Live yeah. sheep, and not grown-up sheep like our biggest sheep, but not like our, you know, like yearlings. I mean, they were huge, and their little heads were sticking out in every direction, and I had no idea how they were keeping those sheep on that scooter.
Maybe it was part of a contest.
Yeah, maybe.
So I wanted to ask you, as we have to wrap up soon, is about are you optimistic at all about India's environmental future?
It's a really difficult question and a good one. I'm thinking about your reaction up in Canada as well. I read a powerful book, Meera Kamdar's book, Planet India, and she's pretty bullish on business, but says, as India goes, so goes the world, and lists the same order of problems that we're talking about. Exploitation of natural resources, big business coming in without regard, a lack of trickle-down of the enormous profits that are being made so that the locals mm-hmm. aren't getting out of poverty yeah. as a result of it. I don't think we came away optimistic. We recognized people making enormous efforts to be clean, clean. Whether population explosion in India will permit that seems to me a major question that'll have to be answered over the next couple of decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the population is the huge problem. And unless they can get a grip on that, there's not a lot of hope for them to sustain.
And I know we're almost out of time, but I have one more question, because for me, when I go out of the country and I come back, I always have this kind of shell shock. How have you integrated India into your lives? What has India meant to you in the long run?
I think we both, and I'll speak for myself, I learned a tremendous amount about Indian religion, religious traditions, history, religions I've often admired from a distance, but now understand more fully and can incorporate that in my personal mm-hmm. philosophy. The other side was I think I'm repeating myself here, but the fact that the efforts are being made. We saw signs on the highway saying, keep it green, keep it clean, don't throw trash out the window, that had been up for 20 years and were already peeling. So there's an awareness there, even as the peeling to me represented the difficulty of getting anything really done in the long haul.
I was impressed here, as I have been in other third world countries that I visited, at the cheerfulness and the patience and the tolerance and the openness and the warmth. And, you know, people didn't have a lot. The people that we met didn't have a lot, but they were all generous to us. Everybody just giving and welcoming. And we were in a number of houses where I, even when I couldn't speak the same language, I felt really comfortable.
Yeah, thank you. And I wanted to make sure that people have a chance to follow up on this. Although we didn't get to talk about everything, Susan, Steve, and Gail Kimball are going to be doing a slideshow and commentary about their trip on Sunday, December 9th, 6 p.m. at the Congregational Church here in Chico. In addition to the environment, they'll discuss education, history, and religion, sex roles, and more. Admission is $10, and it includes an Indian dinner, and all proceeds will be divided between the Shalom Free Clinic and the Open Door Literacy Project that offers education to young people, mostly young women in Pakistan. And if you want more information, you can contact Steve or Susan at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com.
Thank you very much, Chris. We appreciate you giving us a chance to talk about ourselves.
Talk on your own show.
That's
yeah,
right.
It's hard.
Chris will be doing the show again on December 4th, and tentatively your topic will be?
Well, I'm bouncing around as usual. I would like to do it on susceptibility to breast cancer and perhaps get some experts on about what's in our furniture, especially as a breast cancer risk, but we'll have to see how the guest situation comes.
Right. Thank you, Chris, for doing that. And thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much. It's really been
fun talking with you about your trip.
And I want to say ditto about the Canadian people. They're wonderful, too, and I somehow left that out.
Yeah. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by EcoCab, Chico's green alternative taxi service. EcoCab provides safe, reliable transportation 24 hours a day in a new fuel-efficient Toyota Prius. Protect the planet and get to where you need to be with EcoCab, the cab that cares. Call 591-3186.
Thank you very much for listening to Ecotopia. Stay tuned for The Storyteller with Celine O'Malley. Her topic tonight is family heritage.
Sunshine out of the falling rain. Weave me the hope of a new tomorrow and fill my cup again. Sing it with me. Weave me the sunshine out of the falling. Weave me the hope of a new tomorrow. Again now. Weave me the sunshine out of the falling.